and it is the 13th of March. Present for the record, we do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senators Bundy, French, and myself, McGuire. We have five items on the agenda. First up is House Bill 284, PFD, Allowable Absences for Fellowships. And when we last left off, there was an amendment that Senator French had discussed. And I think what we did, there was an objection to the amendment. We withdrew it, right?
I thought the amendment was still pending with the objection pending
as
well.
Okay, so the objection is still pending, and so it is before us as objected to. Further discussion, there were questions about what the program is, how many people are in it, et cetera, et cetera. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you should, and I'm sorry if you did not receive it, you should have received, and you do have now a packet of material I sent around in support of the amendment. It consists of a cover page, a memorandum for the public that may be listening or watching, and then four pages of information about the AmeriCorps. Essentially, the AmeriCorps is a domestic version of the Peace Corps. It's made up of three main programs, AmeriCorps State and National, AmeriCorps Vista, and AmeriCorps National Civilian Community Corps. Essentially, the volunteers work on nonprofits, they work on public and community agencies, and faith-based organizations. A few well-known examples of entities for which an AmeriCorps volunteer may work include Habitat for Humanity, the Red Cross, the United Way, and Boys and Girls Clubs of America. To serve in the AmeriCorps, you must be a lawful U.S. citizen, you must be at least 17 years of age, you serve over a 10 to 12 month period, and upon completion, you're eligible, you don't necessarily get one, but you're eligible for an education award of up to $4,725. About half of the AmeriCorps volunteers receive a modest living stipend during their service. There are 74,000 members nationwide. Our check with the folks at AmeriCorps led us to believe that there, and we put in the memo, we think there are 59 Alaskans affected by this, 59 Alaskans who are outside right now serving in AmeriCorps in the lower 48 doing good works while absent from the state of Alaska. I think the chief sort of reason that the amendment is in front of the committee is because of the iniquity of the Peace Corps exemption and the lack of an AmeriCorps exemption. As I put in the memo, it seems at least as noble to be rebuilding houses in the wake of Hurricane Katrina as it is to be building houses in Africa, or to even draw a sharper distinction, which was made by my one of my House counterparts in debate in the other body, a AmeriCorps volunteer in Juarez, Mexico, could wave his permanent fund dividend check across the river, across the Rio Grande, to a Peace Corps volunteer in Juarez could wave his dividend check across the river to a AmeriCorps volunteer in El Paso, and the El Paso, of course, person wouldn't have a dividend check, and the Juarez, Mexico Peace Corps volunteer would, and so it just seems, you know, how can that be? How can the dividing line? How can the Rio Grande keep an Alaskan in El Paso from not getting a dividend check when an Alaskan in Juarez does? So that's kind of the gist of the amendment. I think we may have available an AmeriCorps person who can answer more questions. The Northwest, is he or on your witness list?
Billy Caldwell is on the line from AmeriCorps. Billy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the AmeriCorps program?
Well, it is a national program that provides opportunities in the United States as well as the territories of the United States. It is the VISTA program in itself. There are those three components to it. The VISTA program is dedicated to fight the war on poverty. The AmeriCorps State and National program provides opportunities for mostly the citizenry of the state in which they live to serve and try to build capacity within their communities and solve community problems using community people as the base for getting to those solutions. It's been around, the VISTA program has been around since 1964 with the first people being placed in Alaska, particularly in 1965. So we've been engaged for a long time, and Vista is sort of the prototype for the other entities of the AmeriCorps programs, like the NCCC and the state and national program. I'd be willing to answer any questions directly that you might want to get an answer to.
Okay. Well, when we've been considering other exemptions, one of the things that's really important, obviously, to Alaskans is that it remain a program that Alaskans benefit from. And so when we're looking at the types of exemptions we make, we try to think about a term of volunteering, if you will, or term of service. In this case, it looks like it is a 10 to 12 month period. But I guess my question is, on the application form itself or in federal law, is it specifically 10 to 12 months, or could it be longer than that? And if so, how many years?
Both VISTA members as well as AmeriCorps members have the opportunity to serve and receive an education award for 2 years, and it doesn't have to be consecutive. We've put sort of a limitation on the number of years that any member can serve to 3 years.
Okay, is that a hard and fast rule?
No, there are allowabilities for an additional year or so, but there is a cap on it for 5 years for sure. Any time after the first two education awards have been earned, they cannot get another education award. It would have to be a stipend, which is a cash out of $1,200.
Okay, well, here's the kind of thing that I would be looking for, and that, I mean, it really takes years to get these exemptions through with a lot of provability and backup. And the kinds of things that, for example, when I got the Peace Corps exemption, the kinds of things that I had were the actual application itself, so that you could see the physical requirements, that it's a federally recognized program. In other words, we don't want to put things into statute that, you know, can be sort of loosey-goosey. So there's the eligibility part. The second part is a little bit better understanding of the term of service, because you also don't want to have a situation where someone goes outside and just sort of keeps renewing over and over and over again and really is living somewhere else, admittedly doing public service, and that's great, but really a long way away from Alaska. These are the kinds of things that'd be nice if you could put into writing or into some greater form of detail. And then finally, is there a requirement for placing the residency to which you will return? In the Peace Corps, when you fill out and are accepted to that federal program, you are required to state your place of residence at that point, and that's where your return plane ticket, if you will, goes back to. So, you know, my mind just races, and I'm thinking this is a great program, great service. Seems like an Alaskan that wanted to do this ought to have it. But you also wouldn't want to have someone come up here, let's say in college, not from here, qualify for residency for purposes of the dividend, then go out and sort of be in a program that was, you know, ongoing 5 and 6 and 7 years and so forth, and then collecting the dividend. I mean, that just really isn't the point of the program. So those are the kinds of thoughts I have right now. Senator Bundy?
Yes. It really isn't possible for a person to do that because we have moratoriums and time limits on them. And just like in the Peace Corps, they have to declare their home of record, and at the end of their service, we provide them with a ticket back to that home of record.
Okay, and is that something that you could provide in writing?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For the next committee?
Sure.
Okay. Senator Bundy?
thank you. You use the term these people serving in their communities, but perhaps to use the word community is a very broad term, because then you mentioned you had sent people on from AmeriCorps to Alaska, obviously not in their community, their service wasn't in their community, and now we're talking about people who from Alaska who are serving in other people's communities. Could you clarify that a little bit, that they're serving in their community?
When I'm referring their community, I'm basically talking about the AmeriCorps state and national program. With that program, it is specifically set up for folks who live within that state to serve in that state. Whereas with the VISTA program, it has always encouraged locally recruited volunteers, but the real effort is to bring people who have completed college into a community and provide some leadership mentoring to build the capacity of the community to deal with their own problems. So when I say from the communities, I'm talking about specifically the state-run program. Those are members who are actually living in their community, working on their community problems.
Okay, I understand. The VISTA and then the AmeriCorps are
national.
A subunit of the other, and this bill would only refer to VISTA volunteers because they're the only ones that would have been...
It would be actually all of them. There are opportunities with the Civilian Corps for them to, let's say you have a project up in Alaska in the Nana. It is a tribal NCCC program, and they could go on spikes, meaning work assignments outside of Alaska, but predominantly they work inside of Alaska on stream restoration, maybe building projects, any community-driven and oriented kind of project.
One question begets another. Could a AmeriCorps/VISTA person who was assigned in Alaska then go on temporary assignment outside of Alaska?
Absolutely. I also have with me Bill Dillon, who is my coworker on the phone, so that he could help answer any specifics to just make sure we give you a complete picture.
Okay, thank you. And I think Senator French said there's some 59 Alaskans serving in VISTA, so that they're working out of the state. Do you have available, or could we get some basic information about where and what they're doing?
I could coordinate with the headquarters office and determine what those assignments are.
And if I might continue, Madam Chair.
Yes, everybody.
And these are mostly college graduates.
The folks who work with the VISTA program are predominantly college graduates.
All right, thank you.
Okay, and you said you had another gentleman with you.
Yes, Bill Dillon.
Okay, can he?
Just one point, and I think it went to an earlier question that that you raised in terms of benefit. The corporation has been involved fairly deeply and is still doing a number of studies with regards to what happens with these folks after service. And one of the things that stands out that I think is important for the committee to know, when these folks complete their term of service, they generally return to their communities. And we're seeing, according to our studies, significant commitments that they make post-VISTA service to serving the public in not-for-profits, in government, education, and other public benefit positions. So these folks, as a result of their service, tend to come back to the communities and work to build healthy communities. So I think that's a really important sideline benefit to encouraging folks to be able to serve.
Yeah, and I found that in my time of research on Peace Corps volunteers as well, that they had a disproportionate involvement in the community, in teaching and in nonprofits and volunteerism.
Absolutely.
So I think that's great. My only question and concern, it's just that I haven't spent a lot of time looking. I've heard of AmeriCorps. I just want to be clear that when we put into statute an exemption, that we have a clear idea of what we're doing, number of people that we're talking about, terms of service, so for how many years we're looking at, and then if there was a way to generate any information about what Alaska AmeriCorps volunteers come back to Alaska, that would be great. I don't know if that kind of information is something you could put together.
It's going to be very difficult to be able to, because one of the things is, as you know, all governments are kind of squeezed for cash now, and it's the type of cost associated with tracking post-service is challenging. We are involved in those studies now, but just how far it breaks down to the individual states, that I can't tell. So it probably would not be immediately available.
Okay, Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just one question. We've talked about 1 to 2 to a maximum of 5 years of service. Maybe you can tell us, since we're not too familiar with the program, what the vast majority of VISTA and AmeriCorps volunteers, what term they put in? What's the standard time that you expect a volunteer to put in?
No more than 3 years.
And what's
but most typically most 1 year with probably 20-30% of individuals who serving a second year, not very often for a third year, and hardly ever for a fourth year.
Mm-hmm. So 80% of your volunteers serve 1 year, and 15% of the remainder of the 100%, 15% serve 2, and maybe 5% serve 3.
And that would probably. As I say, it's probably over 80% in terms of a 1 year commitment to serve and completion. Just don't have numbers in front of me, particularly as it pertains to Alaska.
How long have you been with the VISTA program?
Well, actually, I've been with the corporation for 5 years, but been engaged in directing these VISTA projects for 20 years.
So you've got a fairly lengthy term of familiarity with the program.
Absolutely.
And your current assignment is to oversee the operation of VISTA in which states?
Actually, in Alaska and in Washington.
So you're responsible for just 2 states, and Alaska is one of them?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And I, Billy Caldwell, am responsible just for the state of Alaska. And we administer there, through this office, the National Senior Service Corps programs, foster grandparents, senior companions, and retired senior and volunteers, and the VISTA program.
Okay. Representative Hawker, do you want to offer testimony? Senator Bundy.
While he's coming up, an additional question for the gentleman online. How are people in Alaska recruited and signed up for the program?
Generally, recruitment is done through word of mouth. That seems to be the most effective. We also have a national recruitment, electronic recruitment system that does recruitment in each state. And we also send recruiters out from time to time to colleges and universities. We try to make presentations, particularly early on, meaning in the 1980s, at even high schools. We don't do that so much anymore just because of budget considerations.
Thank you.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And for your record-keeping purposes, I'm Representative Mike Hawker, District 32. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I view the debate on this amendment, I respectfully would submit that it's really not a referendum on the merits of the AmeriCorps program. That's not at issue here. What's at issue is whether or not we're going to expand into a new category, the allowable absence exemptions for permanent fund dividends. And again, that is without any reference to the merits of this particular program. As the philosophy that has existed, very clearly in the expansion of these, or the definition of these exemptions to allowable absences from permanent fund dividends, I think is, again, so well encapsulated once more time in the first statutory exemptions for educational purposes. And, other than, we recognize there's, our students are going to need to go to universities all over the world, so that was a very clear You know, simply, you're not going to be able to avail yourself of an educational opportunity that may be at wherever on a specific interest that we can't guarantee to provide that with our own university system. And then the exemption for other vocational, professional, and specific education actually uses the criteria or establishes the criteria not reasonably available in the state. So on one end, you know, we're looking at this myriad of programs that are being discussed here in this AmeriCorps world is that, you know, some of those are essentially their service programs available for students who want to stay in the state and do work in the state, even within their own structure that is available in the state, an option. The second level I would look at on this amendment again and with is that very clearly the purpose of this bill, which was brought to me by a constituent and, you know, had a number of folks come up since then, was that it was an issue that arose from our regulatory process. You know, it's clearly a choice, a route that regulation writers went down that truly created a situation that I believe we can concur was contrary to the intent of law. where in this amendment, as it comes before us, adds a truly an entirely new program with its own, you know, concerns and questions that's being raised by the committee. And as we raise those questions and discuss those questions, I say in addition to the, you know, my concern that, well, there actually may well be comparable programs in the state. You know, you heard the testimony about they can come, kids can come to Alaska and work on stream bed restoration projects. Well, we have, even in Alaska, the Alaska Youth Restoration Program, which is exactly that. It's a program within the state of Alaska dedicated to stream bed restoration. And then perhaps my last concern is that, and it's in the language that was provided along with the amendment here, the you know, the last page from the AmeriCorps website, and if you'd allow me to cite here, it says very specifically, it says, in exchange, quid pro quo, in exchange for a year of full-time service, AmeriCorps members earn an education award of $4,725 that can be used to pay for college or graduate school or pay back qualified student loans. So, again, I think there's a, you know, just issues here about is someone undertaking this truly from a volunteer interest, or is it in the, you know, the exchange here, the compensation specifically, you know, offered back to it. so that, again, without prejudicing anything against the AmeriCorps program, and I would further acknowledge and recognize the committee to recognize that there's a separate bill that was introduced in the House specifically to undertake this conversation, but in that the bill before us is my effort to right a wrong that has occurred through a regulatory process and not expand the definitions through consideration of a new program. I just respectfully ask the committee to not adopt this amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay, questions for Representative Hawker? Okay, anyone else here in the audience wishing to testify? Anyone else online?
I would like to get a clear understanding. How does the senator see this different from
could you state
the
your name?
Program?
Is this Bill?
This is Billy Caldwell.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Billy Caldwell with AmeriCorps. Say your question again.
How does the gentleman who just spoke see the AmeriCorps program being different from the Peace Corps program?
Madam Chair, I don't think I've ever been questioned by someone who was scheduled to testify, but if you'd like me to answer the question.
I'll ask the question.
I don't know that.
Respectfully.
I'm not sure.
It's a non-germane question,
yeah,
ma'am.
I don't know that Representative Hawker wasn't here proposing a Peace Corps exemption. That's not really the argument. I think, Billy, what I would ask, what I think you would go further with on this is that the bill goes to the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee next. And what I think, and I'm just telling you as someone that sponsored an allowable absence, it took 6 years, and it's not done lightly. It's actually something that, you know, members get, they want to feel comfortable that when they expand the exemptions for the permanent fund that they're doing it in a contained way that truly keeps the focus on residents of Alaska. So what I would do is work with Senator French and the folks that have sponsored the House bill, which my apologies, here it is House Bill number 401. The prime sponsor, Kurtula, Edgman, Gera, Book, a few others. And I would craft, this is a good packet, Senator French, but I would speak specifically to the term of service and how that's renewed and how that's controlled, if you will, what the fine barriers are on that. And then I would look at putting in the application and the requirement of a place for return, residence of record. And so that when you're in the next committee that, you know, you've got those things answered. I support the AmeriCorps program. I think it's a good program, and I generally support people having allowable absences when they're out of the state doing good works. But I think that I don't want to put members in a position where they are pulling a bill out of the House that they haven't heard a lot of testimony on and details on in that spot. But I would also look to Senator French that if there's an objection to his amendment that Senator Green noted, I don't know if she maintains her objection, and so I'd look to Senator French to see how he wants to pursue it. Do you want to vote? Do you want to withdraw it and offer it in Hess? Spend some time working on those members? It's up to you.
Madam Chair, I guess I would just think, I think we've heard good testimony about how big the program is.
Okay.
We know it's essentially chartered, if you will, by the United States government, you know, begun by George Bush the first, continued on by President Clinton, and continued on by the current president. We've heard good testimony that there are a total of 59 Alaskans serving in this program, that 80% of them serve 1 year and then are asked to return to the place where they came from, which is here. We know that the majority of them are college students who graduated from college, that they're doing what we would call good works in the lower 48. They get a fairly modest stipend, and they're eligible for another modest educational stipend when they return. I'm not sure quite much how much more information we would need to get. It strikes me that this is a program of people who will not only do good works during the year they're gone, but sort of by some sort of formative experience, formative effect on their character, continue to do good works throughout the rest of their lives. That's what we've heard from the folks who've had up to 20 years experience in working with the program. So I.
And did you or did anyone else spend any time with the bills? I mean, I guess sort of one other thing that I think about is respect for the people who, you know, who offer the legislation and work it through the process, which takes a lot of work. Has there been any time spent, you know, with the bill's sponsor on this?
I have nothing but respect for Representative Hawker. He and I frequently meet with one another and speak. To answer your question, we have not spoken about this specific amendment. The answer is no.
Okay. Okay. Well, I heard him say that he is not comfortable with it in. I support the AmeriCorps if it comes later to the floor. I'm supportive of the general idea. I support AmeriCorps, but I, for one, am not going to support the amendment at this time in the process, and would be willing to go forward with a vote. But if it's, let's say it fails, I would encourage you to spend some time with Representative Hawker and spend some time getting some of this converted into writing, and then let's look at it further down the line.
I think I might get Senator Bundy, though, so let's go ahead and vote.
Okay. Okay.
Uh-oh.
Madam Secretary.
You're trying to make me sound like a Democrat?
Madam.
Just always a reasonable man.
Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on amendment number one?
Senator Stevens.
No.
Senator Bundy.
No.
Senator Green.
No.
Senator French.
Yes.
Chair McGuire.
No. Okay, and so amendment number one fails to carry, not out of any disrespect to any volunteer. And so that brings the bill back before us, the matter of House Bill 284. Is there a motion? Senator Bundy. Senator Green.
Oh, I would move House Bill 284 from committee with individual recommendations and
Happening, zero fiscal notes.
Okay, and so House Bill 284, with individual recommendations and attached or fiscal note, well, attached fiscal note has moved out of this committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very kindly for a delightful discussion.
You're welcome. Bunny, I was just trying to give you an opportunity to kiss up to your House member. Okay.
A little sport with you.
Next, we have Senator French's bill.
Oh, my gosh.
And that, is that correct, Shalon?
It's like a full day out of it.
I mean, just, yeah, right.
Yes.
Let's just forget what you said.
Senator Bundy, you ready for a motion? Did you hear that? Okay, Senate Bill 153 by Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today with you. The Senate Bill 153 is about providing, giving peace officers and firefighters the opportunity, not the obligation, but the opportunity to buy 5 years of medical benefits when they buy 5 years of retirement benefits. The way it works right now, if you're a former member of the armed forces and you're currently working as a peace officer or firefighter in the state, you may, when you get eligible for retirement, having served 20 years here with the state, you can buy 5 more years of retirement. The difficulty or the problem is that the folks who are buying those 5 years of retirement believe they're also buying 5 years of medical benefits, and they're not. And the disconnection, if you will, is what this bill is about fixing. Let me just go ahead and read the sponsor statement to give you a fuller understanding of what the bill is about. Current law allows a police officer or firefighter who has also served in the armed forces to count 5 years of military service toward their public employee's retirement system and retirement, provided two conditions are met. First, the employee must not be eligible for a federal retirement benefit, and second, the employee must buy those military service years by paying for them. The shortcoming with the current system is that the military years purchased toward a state retirement do not count towards qualifying for retiree medical benefits. Moreover, many of those who are buying in presume that they are getting just that coverage, thus the need for Senate Bill 153. The legislation corrects what many with former military service assume when purchasing military time, and that is that the time purchased will be credited to their medical benefits as well as to their retirement. The bill simply allows for the same purchase of years to count towards retirement and medical benefits. The bill does not allow double dipping because the potential state retiree must not be eligible for federal military benefits in order to qualify for the purchase in the first place. SB 153 recognizes the contribution made by police officers, firefighters who have both served our country through the military and now pursue careers to protect and defend our state and communities. And with that, Madam Chair, I thank you, and I would be happy to answer questions.
Excellent. Questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Green.
From the department, retirement benefits.
Let's see here. Yes, we do. We are.
That's where my question
is. Yes. Okay, any questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Stevens.
What is the qualifying issue on retiree medical benefits? So it doesn't count now towards qualifying. What do you have to do to qualify for medical benefits? What are the requirements to qualify for medical benefits currently?
For Tier 1, of course, it's one set of rules. For Tier 2 and Tier 3, for police and fire, to qualify for medical benefits, you have to either be age 60 or have served 25 years with the state. Those are the two. And for Tier 3, it's the same. Tier 1, of course, has the fabulous medical benefits available to all retirees. And there's a chart supplied in the packet that I frequently refer to because it's confusing to keep track of, but it's a chart that looks like this, and it helps explain that.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions for Senator French? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we will have Pat Shire. Hi, Pat.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pat Shire. I'm the Division Director at the Department of Administration for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And I'm here to answer questions on Senate Bill 153.
Okay, Senator Green.
Yes, and the calculation for the, since we've just been through the greatest most difficult bill in the world to try to restore the PERS and TERS systems to make it a funded program. How does this ensure, or does it ensure, that the participation and the buy-in fully pays for what would have been in and any interest that would have created for those five past years?
Through the chair, Senator Green, the way that the bill currently stated, version A, we don't have that mechanism in place yet. There has been some discussion about a mechanism to have individuals pay for the health care, but the way it reads currently under this this version, there's an addition of about $5.3 million to the unfunded liability, and for that reason, the administration has not been excited about the bill. We understand that there are certainly some issues here that may deserve consideration, but we're unable to be supportive over a measure that would add that kind of unfunded liability without being more clear on how it would be paid for.
Yeah. And Ms. Madam Chairman, I would just have to say that until that question is answered, I cannot possibly support this. I cannot even go near creating any more debt liability for those programs.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I'm looking at your fiscal note that you submitted, which was some $350,000. How does that mesh with your $5 million?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, what you have before you is the first 5 years of those effects. And the first year is predicated on our knowledge that there are currently 203 individuals that are police fire members who have already elected to use their military service time in order to qualify for increased retirement benefits. And they are either paying for those or they're saving money right now in other places like SBS in order to pay for that when they step out the door. Now, our assumption is that those 203 who have already presented and saying, I'm going to use that for retirement benefits, would also step forward and say, now that there's this additional enhancement, we would like that as well. And so this is the current year's cost of that 5.3. The unfunded liability, as you're aware, when we become aware of a new unfunded liability, it's amortized according to the current program that the Arm Board has selected over 25 years. So this $347,000 represents a small portion of the current service cost, and most of it is the beginning to amortize the significant addition to the unfunded liability over 25 years. As you see, the in 2010, 2011, 2012, and then it then flattens out at 2013 and 14, we're assuming that that percentage of individuals, which is around 8%, 203, would grow to as much as 15% of the police fire population. We don't know who those people are. They're not required to tell us who they are when they walk in the door and take a job. And whether they're planning on taking the military time or not. There are some other things that are associated with declaring military time under the current law, which don't really require them to do it until they perhaps get later on in their career. Some do it right away when they're in the door. A number of them don't until they're just getting ready to walk out the door and they write the check at that time. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
But new hires would not be eligible for this program because they're hired under the new retirement system and not the tier two or three. So these would just be people that are currently employed, but you don't know if would want to take an opportunity to use this.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, with the you're spot on with the exception of those individuals that may already have prior tier two and tier three service
and then would hire back.
Correct.
Okay. Not new hires, but rehires could qualify. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, further questions? Yes, Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. For the retirement benefits, what's the average cost? What does a person have to come out of pocket to buy those retirement that extra 5 years? It's 8.5%, I think, for most folks. And how much money does that work out to be?
Madam Chair, if I could, I'd have Kathy Lee with me here, who knows far more than I do about those details. I'd like her to join me.
Okay. welcome.
For the record, my name is Kathy Lee, and I'm the retirement manager for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The calculation for military service, Senator French, is about 8.5% of the vesting year salary for each year that's claimed. So a military claim for somebody right at 5 years, if they claim it right at 5 years, would typically be around $25,000. It will gain interest as long as it is unpaid, or if they wait to claim it later, interest begins the year after they vest. So the amount would grow even if they waited to claim it later.
At actual retirement.
At actual retirement. And at retirement, they have a choice of either making a payment in full, or they can take it as a lifetime reduction to their retirement benefit.
In essence, move it from one account to the other, so to speak, by taking it out of the, maybe you can explain that a little more.
When an individual retires and they have claimed military service, they can still see some increase to their retirement benefit in the calculation without making any payment at all, because they can take a lifetime reduction to their benefit in order to do so.
To pay for it, in essence.
To pay for it over their lifetime. So in
essence, you can amortize, you'd mortgage the payment over your retirement.
Right. So, for example, if it would increase your retirement benefit by $400 a month if you paid it, if you amortize it over your lifetime, you may only see a $200 increase in your benefit, but you still see an increase.
And that's for the retirement benefits. What about for the medical costs? What would be the increased payment for the medical retirement benefits, if any? Is there any?
Through the chair, Senator French, the way this is structured right now, there is
no additional cost.
No additional cost to the member.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Senator Bundy.
But there would be then an additional cost to the state.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's correct.
And that's the fiscal note, that's the down payment is 347 or whatever the number was.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, this fiscal note is specifically for adding the additional medical benefit that currently does not exist in statute. So we have the old law, which still allows an individual with military time to present at retirement and without writing a check at all, simply say, oh, I'd get 400 if I wrote the check, but I can get two if I do nothing. Mm-hmm. Pay me the two, I'm happy. And that is stacked on top of their underlying pension retirement benefit. Mm-hmm. Whatever the medical is at that time, depending on their eligibility, their tier, their years of service, that remains constant. If we change the way that we award medical coverage right now under this bill, then this would be the increased cost. There's a subtlety here that Kathy has to help me with quite a bit, because she's very knowledgeable on this, and there are two things that we calculate at retirement. One of them is years of service for eligibility for pension at all. That's vesting and can I retire now? And the other one is years of service in dollars for the pension amount, the amount of money. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm a good student.
You did good.
So in this case, what we're talking about is years of service for eligibility to even have access to the medical, not what amount it might be. And I'm sorry if that's unclear.
I thought I understood.
Senator Green, but at age 65, do they then receive this benefit automatically?
Through the chair, Senator Green, at age 60, they would receive system paid medical premiums, or if they had 25 years of membership service in police fire.
So this is very much lower. The bar is very much lower than the average person in the world would ever receive all full benefits. Because this would, you could essentially do this at 50. I mean, you're 5 years of military and you're 20 years of state service, and then pay these fees and qualify for full benefits for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite like you get to the qualifying year and don't get insurance ever. health insurance ever.
Senator French?
With the caveat that at age 65, you go into Medicare. You don't stay on state insurance past 65. No, nobody does.
Well, you do. You have it.
Right.
Pat?
I can help you with that through the chair, Senator French. Medicare by federal law becomes primary, but the state of Alaska still has significant obligation, liability, and opportunity, I guess, to pay medical bills for retirees. There are things that Medicare doesn't contemplate or things that Medicare doesn't contemplate as fully as members might enjoy. We pay $384 million a year in retiree medical benefits.
For people over 65?
For all retirees.
But what about for people over 65 that are on Medicare?
We
don't split that out?
We do for both, no.
You didn't have it broken out.
You don't break out those people? You don't know what you pay for people that are on Medicare versus what you pay for people that are between, say, 50 and 65, the ones that
probably,
Senator Green was talking about?
Through the chair, Senator French, we certainly do. The actuaries, when they're pricing the unfunded liability going forward, we are always aware of how many people are out there right now or who could present themselves for retirement prior to age 65 or Medicare age, as we like to say, because who knows, that may change. So we certainly value those things in, but I just wanted to make clear that there is a benefit both if you retire before age, eligibly retire before age 65, and then after age 65. We pay for a significant amount of medical expenses for both populations.
But the $300 million figure you quoted was not for people over age 65. That was for all retirees.
Right. Through the chair, if I've been unclear, that's correct. It's for all retirees.
And does it get more expensive or less expensive when they become 65 and go on to Medicare as a primary payer?
Through the chair, obviously less expensive.
Less expensive.
Right.
But you can't tell me how many, by how many millions?
Through the chair, I could tell you, but I can't tell you at the moment.
I was afraid you were going to say you'd have to hurt me if you told me, but.
No.
I would be interested to know what that number is.
Very well.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so we're going to hold the bill over. Can you, Pat, please work on providing to the committee and to Senator French the information that he just requested? Is there anyone else here in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill number 153? Anybody online?
Pat.
Okay, and Senator Green has a question.
Okay, could you do...
Oh, there is one.
It's my assumption that the calculation for the amount to be paid by the person who's going to buy in should go back to their date of coming into the program. Because normally anyone who's going to qualify for a future program would be paying their share and it watch it grow over those 20 years. What would be the difference in the calculation for that person who buys their ticket on the way out than the one who buys in from the beginning with an average salary? And because I'm still very concerned about the cost to the state and to the liability.
Through the chair, Senator Green, we've estimated, our actuary has estimated, that the average cost per member per year of claimed military service to add this additional year of medical coverage that for which they would not otherwise be eligible is $6,292 per year, and that's today. That'll be revalued every year going forward as medical costs change. So if somebody presented today and said, I want to buy several years of military service, this is the amount that we would attempt to collect. One of the if we had a way to do that, as I mentioned when I came to the table, the language that I see before me does not provide us a mechanism to collect that money directly from the individual for medical care. It does for retirement service.
Well, in making that calculation and adding that provision, I also want to know what would the calculation be if they bought in early? And you had the expectation for their 20 years of service, what they were accruing, just like any other employee. It's hard to say. I mean, because it's hard to say you don't have to participate fully for 20 years of service. only for the five, but if you had to calculate what the value of that would be early on. That's all I want to know. If I've made myself unclear, then talk to me later.
Madam Chair, if that'd be all right, we could use some clarification. We can get those numbers.
Thank you.
Okay, there is one person, Maurice Hughes.
Yes, Madam Chair, how are you this morning?
Good morning, just fine. Why don't you go ahead and offer your testimony?
My name is Maurice Hughes. I'm a law enforcement officer. I work in Kodiak, Alaska. I'm also a veteran. I'm also a Tier 2 employee. And I believe this bill is a good bill for law enforcement and firefighters who have both served their country and now serving the state and the people of Alaska. This does kind of close that door that if you buy your military service, that you can have your medical benefit at the end of your 20-year basic retirement. As Senator French said, you know, it's the ability to when you purchase that retirement service credit, that you have the ability to get that medical. I'd say that public safety workers, both fire and police, they undergo tremendous stress on the job on a daily basis. The medical component is a very important component in the retirement benefit. And I think this just closes that door that a person that reaches that 20-year retirement and has already served the country and the state of Alaska through military service to be able to purchase that additional 5 years and have the medical benefit trail along with it is a good and appropriate thing for our veterans. We can also look at retention and recruitment, both in police and fire. It's an ongoing battle throughout the state. And I think as far as retention, I think for military members that have come to state service in the public safety sector, if they look at staying in the public safety sector, this is just another one of those benefits that could keep them on the job. It's been a tough road to keep law enforcement, specifically law enforcement members, on the job. I think Senate Bill 153 will allow those veterans to purchase that purge time, get that retirement benefit. I think it also can be used, it was mentioned earlier, as a recruitment to bring those folks back that might be prior Tier 2 or Tier 3 members, you know, to maybe look at the benefits again and maybe come back to service. And this could be used as another retention tool to bring police and fire members back to complete their service through their 20 years. And I also finally think it's a good bill, and it shows support for our veterans that have come back to the state of Alaska and have served both in the military and now serving in the public safety sector. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions for Mr. Hughes? Good testimony. Okay, anyone else online?
Madam Chair, there's also Paul Fussy.
Okay.
Here as well, like to testify.
Great. Paul, would you like to go ahead and offer your testimony?
Madam Chair, I'm a Tier 3 state employee. My name is Paul Fussy. I am also out of Kodiak. And like I said, a Tier 3 employee, Senate Bill 153 would benefit me. I am a veteran, 8 years active duty and currently 9 years so far in the Air National Guard in Alaska. And for it would benefit me. I've already purchased 5 years myself. And then I was one of the few that purchased it under the assumption that it would count for my medical. But just want to quote one stat. The average age of death for police officers in a 40-year study was 66 years of age. And that was by John Vellante, a PhD. And this would help the police and fire for their medical and to purchase the 5 years and help them out for their retirement. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and your service. Any questions? Okay, hearing and seeing none. Anybody else here in the audience? Anyone else online I've overlooked? Okay, so we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 153. Want to move it? We better not. Okay, so we'll go ahead and set Senate Bill 153 aside. And
they'd never know.
You just never, I know. Oh, I think the Senate President would know. She'd find out. Okay. And so the next bill we have is House Bill 296. Whose bill is this? Oh, Bob Lynn's office. Okay. Welcome to Senate State Affairs. I don't know. Maybe you might have more luck today here.
Okay. My name is Mike Sika. I'm staff for Representative Bob Lynn. He couldn't be here today.
Okay.
Taking care of his wife, who's recovering well from surgery. He sends his best.
Great.
And he appreciates the State Affairs Committee hearing HB 296, which extends the termination date of the Board of Parole. Again, it simply extends it another 8 years, which is recommended in the legislative audit report and is the same amount of time as the previous term. Pat Davidson's here from the Division of Legislative Audit, and she's available for questions that you may have on that report. Dwayne Peebles is here from the Department of Corrections as well, and online should be Alaska Parole Board Vice Chair Mike Stark in Fairbanks, and the board's Executive Director Kathy Matsumoto in Anchorage. So I just want to say thank you and good morning, and Representative Lynn, hope she can support this bill to renew the board for another 8 years and suspend the sunset operations scheduled to begin in June.
Okay. Questions for the bill's sponsor's representative? Okay, no questions.
No, just
Senator French.
Just for the record, maybe I know what it does, but for the public, explain what the Board of Parole does, how many cases it handles annually, who it's made up of, and so forth. And it doesn't have to be, it can be anybody. I'm not
right. Well, if Kathy's online, she can explain that. I can say on the record quickly that its primary responsibilities are to determine prisoner suitability for discretionary parole and setting conditions for that, and that they hold parole revocation hearings to determine how that's operating as well. If you would like to ask, I believe Kathy Matsumoto.
I'm here. This is Kathy Matsumoto.
Hi, Kathy. Do you want to go ahead and respond to Senator French's question?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do. We're getting a much better idea of how many active cases we have. We transition with the number of cases coming in, and we probably have approximately 1,200 cases on active supervision at any given time. And there were some statistics made available, and we did approximately 497 hearings that the board held. In addition to that, they set mandatory parole conditions for offenders that are releasing to supervision, and that was approximately 800 of those that were done this last year. We also see quite a number of folks that are incarcerated that request an early release to discretionary parole. And those hearings are conducted throughout the state. And we also have quite a number. We're seeing that about 22% of our hearings are conducted telephonically due to the number of people incarcerated throughout the state of Alaska that we can't travel to and do the hearings for when they're required. So our five board members are very busy in the state of Alaska. They also conduct preliminary hearings for someone that's on parole supervision that gets arrested, and there needs to be consideration given to the fact whether or not they should remain incarcerated pending a final hearing or if there are any options for releasing them back into the community. And we spend a lot of time coordinating our issues with the Department of Corrections. We have a lot of contact with victims groups in the state. We're definitely trying to work with any kind of transition programs in the community to help our offenders stay out of jail. We're very concerned about that. So we're trying to take a very active role in the community in working with our offenders and trying to help protect the public, but at the same time work with offenders and trying to keep them in the community and being productive citizens.
Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ms. Matsumoto, is there any way to sort of generalize what percentage of discretionary parole requests that you grant or that the board grants?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, we granted approximately 57 last year. That was about 40% of the people that we saw.
So am I clear in understanding that only 110 or so people asked for discretionary parole release, and of those, you granted 57, meaning about 40%?
Madam Chair, we saw approximately 140 individuals, and we granted parole to 40% of them, and we denied 46%. And then there are always folks that we see that we're not quite prepared to make a decision on. The board's not quite prepared to make a decision, and we continued another 14% to later on hearings for a number of reasons.
Senator French, isn't it the case that at the federal level, there is no parole now? You don't allow it.
That's my understanding. My understanding. I need to hear from someone. I need to hear from someone in the federal system. I know you don't accumulate good time.
And that's it.
Although a good time is sort of an automatic reduction in your sentence, it may be that you can win discretionary parole release in the federal system. I don't know if Mr. Peoples knows about that. Looks like he's saying he'd rather not answer that question.
And this is Kathy Matsumoto. I'm not aware of discretionary parole in the federal system.
It's interesting.
And I think the committee's probably sitting here thinking to itself, Ms. Matsumoto, I'll just express maybe the thought that's going through other people's minds, and that is, why do we have such a high rate of discretionary parole? I know there have been some recent cases where folks who were recently released, and I can't remember whether they're on discretionary parole or good time release, but we see folks getting out of prison, committing other crimes, and the community just has just zero tolerance for that. And I know you're under a different sort of mandate to look closer at each individual set of circumstances, but I guess I just need to pass back to the parole board that folks in my community are hostile to individuals who get out of prison and then commit another crime.
Mr. French, could I see if Mike Stark is present in Fairbanks? Mr. Stark, are you there?
Through the chair, yes, this is Michael Stark. I am present here in Fairbanks.
Well, and this is Kathy again. I'm wondering if you could share some information with the committee about the board's decisions for discretionary parole.
Sure, Madam Chair, with your permission?
Yes.
Please.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Senator French, the reason I'm in Fairbanks, as you probably remember, I live in Juneau. I'm the Southeast member on the board. The board is actually meeting in Fairbanks doing 2 days of hearings here. Regarding discretionary parole hearings, that's actually a small part of the board's duties. We only, 28% of our number of hearings that we conducted were for discretionary parole. But the one thing that is probably not known much by the public is that there are probably hundreds of prisoners who are eligible for discretionary parole that don't even bother applying because they don't believe they're going to be granted. And in most cases, they're probably right. It's only those who have the most promising records, either in the community or in prison or a combination of the two, that even seek a discretionary parole. There's obviously some exceptions to that, and those persons are very readily denied by the board. So for those actually who are eligible for parole, we grant a very low percentage. These are only persons who have the most impressive records, who are very good risks in the community. And in fact, that's borne out because there are just a very small handful of discretionary parolees out in the community who end up committing crimes. Sometimes there are technical violations. That's more frequent. But I think the concern that you and your constituents have is one that board members have. We feel like our client is the state of Alaska, the people of the state of Alaska, and we have our primary obligation to them is protection of the public. And secondarily, we want to assist offenders to succeed in the community because ultimately almost all offenders are out there eventually, and we want to make sure that they have the tools to succeed when they're out there so we're not just setting them up for failure and creating new victims. I hope that responds to your question.
Thank you. And I'm wondering whether the legislative audit took a look at success rates of the board, the predictability of success, and so forth. And it looks like we're going to hear an answer.
Thank you. For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. During our review, we looked at the discretionary parole decisions made by the board. We have in that report, I believe it was in your packet, page 12 and 13 are the most relevant. What it shows is we took a look at the risk factors that the board uses in making its decision, and then we tested those. And the test for effectiveness that we used was parole revocation. What we found is that for those that they consider the lowest category of risk, the board did grant the highest percentage number of paroles. Conversely, those that had the highest risk category got, as a percentage, the lowest number of discretionary paroles. When you ran that against parole revocations to test the effectiveness of that risk assessment being done by the board, we saw the correlation that we had hoped to see. That being that those with the lowest risk categories had the lowest rate of revocation. Those with the highest risk categories had the highest rate of revocations. One of the things that we attempted to do in the report, however, we felt we couldn't get sufficient apples-to-apples comparison, was to take a look at, in total, the now that we understand what the rate for revocation is for these discretionary parolees, what is it compared to people on mandatory parole? We couldn't do that. All I could say is that it suggests that discretionary parole revocation rates are lower than mandatory, but we couldn't find enough evidence to really say it. So I'd say the most I could say is that the evidence would suggest it. As part of the recommendations in the report, we're suggesting that the board produce annual reports, put out more information about their activity so that the public can do it. And I think they concurred with that recommendation. And I think as they go through that, looking at parole revocation as a test of effectiveness would be one of those areas that they could generate more information for the public.
Okay. Thank you very much, Pat. Okay. Anything you want to add, Michael Stark?
No, thank you, Madam Chair, although I'm certainly ready to respond to any additional questions.
Thank you. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. From what I've heard Pat say, I think at first it seemed counterintuitive, but then I thought about it a moment longer, and it seems logical. You basically cherry-pick those that look like they're going to have the greatest potential of being rehabilitated into society and give them discretionary parole. And so when it comes to mandatory parole, whether you're a good risk or a bad risk, you probably are going to get out. So the discretionary people, or your judgment on the discretionary parole is better, and you know, the results are more successful than with mandatory. So I guess it is logical after a moment.
And Madam Chair, this is Michael Stark. If I could briefly respond to Senator Bundy.
Yes.
Thank you. For those who don't know, anybody who gets a sentence or combination of sentences of 2 years or longer, with some few exceptions, particularly for repeat sex offenders who no longer earn good time, those persons get out on parole automatically for the amount of period of time of good time that they've earned, which the system provides a third off for good time for those who follow the rules. So they're supervised on mandatory parole for the amount of good time they've earned. And the board has no control over who gets out. And as Senator Bundy has suggested, those persons are much more likely to to violate their parole and the board to revoke them than discretionary parolees.
Further questions?
Well, just a suggestion that I know good time is the only carrot they have, but maybe that needs to be looked at.
Okay. Any further, Kathy Matsumoto, anything else you'd like to add?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, anyone else here in the audience to testify on House Bill 296? Anyone else online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then we'll close public testimony on House Bill 296, and I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bundy.
I would move that we move from committee House Bill 296 with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendation.
Is there an objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, House Bill 296 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note has moved out of Senate State Affairs. That brings us to House Bill 286, impersonating a public servant by Representative Dahlstrom. Hi. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer Baxter, staff to Representative Nancy Dahlstrom. And she apologizes for not being able to be here today. I believe she was needed for a quorum. So.
Okay, we understand.
Yeah. Before you is House Bill 286. It is an act relating to impersonating a public servant. Current state law says that unlawfully impersonating a peace officer is a misdemeanor. The bill would increase the penalty to a Class C felony. Unfortunately, Madam Chair, there are those in society who use deception as part of a criminal act. One way is to lure unsuspecting victims by pretending to be someone they are not. Yes. And with this criminal behavior, a desire to intentionally mislead another should have a stronger punishment. There is growing concern for safety in our communities. House Bill 286 adds teeth to existing law and provides another tool to law enforcement agencies. The bill also serves as a deterrent for those who deliberately make choices that put our families, neighbors, and communities at risk. I know that one question that arose was, would this bill make impersonating a public servant as such as a representative, senator, now a Class C felony? No. What we are doing is adding an additional section here that would separate impersonating a public servant from impersonating a peace officer. So this is for if you're impersonating a state trooper, policeman.
Where is that defined?
In section here on the first page. Line 4, impersonating a public servant in the first degree. So we added a classification of for first degree would be Class C felony. Second degree would remain a Class B misdemeanor.
It's okay. I think you misunderstood the question. The question was, how is public servant defined? And it's defined in 1181-900-B54 as the following: whether compensated or not, but does not include jurors or witnesses. It's an officer or employee of the state, a municipality, or other political subdivision of the state, or a governmental instrumentality of the state, including lawmakers, members of the judiciary, and peace officers. A person acting as an advisor, consultant, or assistant at the request of, the discretion of, or under contract with the state. This is pretty expansive, actually.
That's correct. That's the.
So it is a lawmaker.
If you're current law, if you're impersonating a public servant in the second degree, then it is a Class B misdemeanor. If you're impersonating a public servant in the first degree,
just a point of.
Okay.
No, I beg your pardon. No, I beg your pardon. Just a point of order. There's only one crime right now on the books, right?
Correct.
On the books right now is impersonating a public servant, and it's a Class B misdemeanor.
Correct.
Okay. All right. I don't mean to throw you off, but we were jumping over to the new crime,
yeah.
And I just wanted to stick on what we have right now.
Yeah, Madam.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Senator French, that is correct. That's, I believe, what we're doing is separating or adding this new classification that it is a public servant, but we are saying impersonating a public servant in the first degree would be impersonating by pretending to be a peace officer. And the definition of a peace officer, I believe, is anyone who's in the packet here, as such as a state trooper, policeman, VSPOs, I believe, are included as well.
And does that include firefighters?
No.
Peace officer?
Not in this. the statute that we found, no, that would pertain to this bill. I spoke to Ledge Legal, and there is a legal opinion with Jerry Lockup that it didn't need to be that particular definition. So.
Okay. So let's see here. Okay, this legal memo right here, dated February 11th.
Correct.
Do you have that in your packet?
Yeah.
Okay, so it looks to me like public servant is defined that way,
mm-hmm.
54A through D. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Okay. So it's pretty expansive. I mean, it does include legislators, members of the judiciary, peace officers, so on and so forth. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that is my understanding, Madam Chair, that...
Yeah, on that point.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, I've known a few people in my 16 years here who would be charged with impersonating a legislator.
Madam Chair, I saw that coming a week ago. I just want everybody to know that I saw that coming a week ago. Thank you for saying so.
For being so consistent.
However, my question is, why not just say peace officer? I mean, why are we concerned about somebody impersonating a legislator?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Bundy, so in current law, it says a person, if they impersonate a public servant, it is a Class B misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. That's already there.
Yeah.
So what we did is we added, now it's a another classification that if you're impersonating someone in the first degree, they separated it here in line 5 and 6. A person commits the crime of impersonating a public servant in the first degree if the person violates Alaska Statute 1156-830 by pretending to be a peace officer, and impersonating a public servant in the first degree is a Class C felony. So I think that's
just
how they wrote the bill.
The police officer is the, if I might, Ms.
Yes.
Chair,
expanded that's the addition.
Penalty is going to be limited to police officers. Okay.
Correct.
I was hoping to use that, but...
Drat. I find it odd that we have that law on the books.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, and we do. We're going to wrap up here. Let's go ahead and set this bill to the side. Let's take any testimony we have and then set it to the side. Rob Cox with Public Safety?
Yes.
Would you like to offer testimony on House Bill 286?
I would. First of all, I think that it's important that the committee know that being a Class B misdemeanor, the offense of impersonating a public servant, which under current law includes a peace officer, is such a low class of crime that, one, it seldom gets prosecuted at a B misdemeanor level, and secondly, it's something that, unless it's committed in the presence of a peace officer, it's not an arrestable offense unless a citizen affects that arrest, which very, very seldom happens. I think that, as Jennifer pointed out, there is a great potential for loss of public trust unless people that impersonate peace officers and attempt to exercise authority in that office or under that pretension, that we lose our public trust and the ability for policemen to do their job effectively. Up to this point, I know of no tragic outcomes in Alaska, although other states have not been nearly as fortunate. And the real disturbing part about that is that you don't know what the intent of the person pretending to be a police officer is until there is some tragedy or not. And at that point, it's just too late, and it's just too much of a risk. We had, I know of three incidents in my 17-year career where we've apprehended persons who have impersonated a peace officer. Just recently out in the Matsu Valley,
One was just a number of weeks ago. One was apprehended. On the report by a citizen that this person was attempting to pull people over in a car that looked like a police car, was equipped like a police car with lights and radio, so he was able to get on the radio frequencies. But unfortunately, because it wasn't committed in any of the officer's presence, he could not be arrested and his car impounded and things. Interestingly and ironically, when he was contacted by the troopers in the valley, he was DUI, and as odd as it sounds, the officer that stopped him was glad that he was DUI, because he was then able to arrest him, impound his vehicle, and stop the offense. And looking at his history, he had been charged previously by Anchorage police for the same offense and was still out doing this type of behavior. So obviously, as a B misdemeanor, it wasn't much of a deterrent for the crime. So I just want to state that Public Safety Employees Association, the troopers and the police officers we represent who work the road, are very much in support of this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Question from Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is a serious issue, and I take it very seriously, but what about, I mean, there's some common sense here. A child in a Halloween costume, you're not going to arrest them, are you?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, absolutely not. As we testified on the House side of this bill to some of these same types of questions, there's really three levels of filtering, if you will, before somebody would be prosecuted for something like that. And the first is the officer's discretion. I mean, we have to get a complaint that somebody is actually impersonating a peace officer. And then we would investigate it, or at least check on it, look into it. And if clearly that wasn't happening, then it just is no common sense at all to charge, like you said, a child in a Halloween costume, or even an adult at a costume party. And then you have the DA's office. If charges were forwarded on somebody, then the DA's office would look through it and see whether it's prosecutable. If they believe that it was truly an offense, then it would go to the court, and then you have the due process in court. So it really would be difficult to prosecute somebody on something like that.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarification.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Stevens, in the legal opinion from Jerry Luckup, it also states because I did ask him, what about the Halloween exemption, I guess we could call it, and the person would have to wear the costume and then engage in some act or activity.
Yeah.
In the capacity of that officer.
Yeah, well, and I do know, and it's been years now, but I recall a series of incidents, maybe it's been 2 years, where a man was impersonating a police officer in the municipality of Anchorage, and in the premise, pulling young women over and raping them, assaulting them. And it is very serious, because we have this healthy respect for law enforcement, and yet if somebody were to abuse that, that you could really see where someone could end up in trouble. So, Senator French, any further comments? I guess we're prepared to move it out. We've got three of us here. Is there any amending that we think we need to do? Any concerns members have? Senator French?
Madam Chair, I think this goes on to the Judiciary Committee.
Oh, good.
And my concern is the level of the crime, and so I'll be talking to the bill sponsor. The issue I have is that in most instances, the uniform is used to commit some heinous crime. And the heinous crime, frankly, is usually punishable by, you know, a lengthy prison sentence. And there are certainly times when you could stop a person from committing the heinous crime if you can just simply bust them from having a uniform on. But they still have to do the official act. Right? You're still left with that sort of that one act they have to commit. And the difficulty I'm having, and I'll frame the question to the bill sponsor so she has plenty of time to prepare an answer for for the Judiciary Committee is, you know, under what circumstances is it appropriate to put a felony conviction on someone when their own, when the only thing they've done is just sort of act like a cop and they haven't committed the more serious crime? Because my sense is that having committed the more serious crime, you're down the road. We're going to send you away for a long time. And an A misdemeanor allows you to put a person in jail for a year. And a year is a long time.
Yeah.
And so I'm concerned about going all the way up to a C felony, skipping over the A misdemeanor. And thankfully, it hasn't been a problem in this state. And the only other point I'll make is that we heard a bill in Judiciary, I think just yesterday, about burning cars in the valley.
Right.
Or burning cars in other parts of the state. And we heard from a fire marshal who said it had happened, I think, 60 times in the northern tier of Alaska last year. And with a like number probably in Jim Creek. So there's 120, maybe 150 incidents every year of people burning cars. And that, you know, that seems to be the kind of thing that gets your attention and you react and make a felony. And I don't want to downplay this because this is a very serious thing to do, but I have a lingering concern about the level of the crime.
Okay. Thank you, Senator French. Those are good comments. And so if I would entertain a motion. Senator Stevens.
Madam Chairman, we move House Bill 286 out of committee with the fiscal notes. 2-0 fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay, any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, House Bill 286, 2-0 fiscal notes and individual recommendations has moved.
Thank you.
We are adjourned. Thank you.